The Guardian.
World Cup Daily with James Richardson on Guardian.co.uk.
Day 17 at the World Cup, and yes, Germany, England, 4-1. England rogered on the counter like a shopkeeper's tart. Terry and Upson, more like Terry and June. And Capello, more like Crapello. There, I said it. Reaction and comment coming up. Plus, Sunday night's game. Argentina go through Carlito's way with a Tevez-powered win over Mexico, setting up a quarter-final rematch with the Mannschaft from 4 years ago. Tasty. Also on our agenda today, after Sunday's howlers, should refs use technology or would glasses do the job? The pod debates. And that Monday lineup of matches, Holland-Slovakia, after driving them batty in Bratislava, can the Weiss guys pull off another upset? And what of Brazil-Chile? Will Chile pepper the Brazilian box, where by definition surely things can't get hairy? All that and much, much more under discussion on today's World Cup Daily. Hello there, world. Here with me today, John Ashdown of The Guardian, Amy Lawrence of The Observer, and Barney Rone, the man who taught Fabio Capello everything he knows about being a manager. With that book of yours,
yeah,
Barney.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? I mean, he was doing so well. And then there was this story about all the things the England players were taking, and I very proudly pointed out that he was taking my book. And then almost instantly, everything went completely wrong.
It did, didn't it?
Capello seemed to lose his marbles. And nobody could quite understand what had gone wrong with him.
So, except for you, Barney.
Yeah.
Who, but in the meantime, you have redeemed yourself by coming up with probably the top line on Lampard's not allowed goal.
What line was that?
Go on. This is what Barney said to me. What's the similarity between Lampard's shot and the SAS? They're both undetected behind German lines. You have to respect that, no?
Okay, invisible behind German lines. That's the phrase, isn't
it? Oh, okay. Invisible.
But I didn't say it was good.
I think it's terrific.
Thanks.
It's a job for you on a red top somewhere. That's excellent. Now, so much to discuss, and boy, do we come correct today, because Barney's got a notepad. John Ashdown, you've got 2 pages of notes and some kind of nicked off zonalmarking.com team layouts.
These are available on guardian.co.uk.
Oh, right, nice one. Point out. Yeah, proper. And Amy, well, you look lovely. Nice one. As I say, so much to discuss. Let's just wade straight in on this long-awaited game that will be long remembered for all sorts of reasons, both here and in Germany. Happy Goth says the most important thing about today's events, the psychic octopus was right. And indeed it is. It's on quite a roll, that...
You didn't need to be a psychic octopus to see this one coming, really, did you?
I mean, well, I don't know. You see, yesterday's pod, I was the lone voice of dissent as everybody backed England.
Who was on yesterday's pod?
Barry.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And Jacob Steinberger. Barry, though, it should be said, was furiously tweeting as the goals rained in about John Terry's responsibility in 75% or 100% of them. Amy, I know you were listening to Five Live on your way in, and I heard a bit of talk sport there. I said it earlier.
That's more shameful than saying
Well, Capello. It's an interesting little way of, you know, taking the temperature of, you know, fans like me who love the game. There was a lot of talk of spirit and how the players don't have spirit. Five Live, it was more Capello.
Yeah, they went straight for the manager, and it took them literally no time at all to bring in the old chestnut that, well, it's these foreign managers and we need a good old-fashioned English manager to solve our English problems, which just had me laughing like a drain, really, because... clearly, people don't remember what happened the last time that England had an English manager and not even qualified for a tournament. I just think that people are avoiding the wider problem, and it's very, very easy to look at the manager and blame the manager. But this is a guy with a fantastic track record who basically has gone to some unbelievably high-profile club jobs and won everywhere. Yet it's his fault that England make a mess of things. However, you just have to look at the fact that England can make a mess of things entirely by themselves, whoever is the manager. And I'm just not quite so sure that the finger of blame should be exclusively pointed at the manager.
Well, before we go any further with this, unless, Barney, you wanted to leap in straight away.
Well, I was just going to say, I think Amy's completely right. It's ridiculous to blame the manager, but he probably should go.
You made the point earlier, he's a results man,
he's
and he didn't bring
man.
Results.
I'm not sure he wants to stay.
There was absolutely no point in having Capello as England manager if you're losing 4-1 to Germany. You're not investing anything, resources or time in this man. He's an old Italian man who could probably be quite happy somewhere else doing just as good a job.
But especially when you look at the defensive performance that England put in today, for that to be overseen by an Italian coach is some kind of weird
sacrilege. I don't blame Capello for that. Although there is some sort of, I mean...
That's the very least that you'd expect for him to sort out first and foremost. You know, things. If you want to argue the toss about whether Joe Cole plays up front or this one or Gerald...
What could he have done with the defence?
It.
The problem is a lack of speed and mobility. And we don't have the
players
to do anything
about. But
there are
teams who don't have fast players, but they set up in a different way, don't they?
Well, they
try and make sure they don't lose
two
the ball with half the players up the wrong
end.
Yeah, well,
I mean, losing the ball is the other English disease, isn't it? Mm. Apart from the other English diseases that happen at prep schools. Nice shorts, by the way, James.
And to think people thought that you and I don't get on, buddy.
Watching the Argentina-Mexico game afterwards, I'm not sure they've got great defences either. So I think it's a bit facile in a way.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter because they have superstar names who perform.
But the difference is that Argentina and Mexico don't give the ball away every 10 seconds. It was a completely different game of football there. They were playing at a much slower pace. Yeah. The defence was not exposed constantly, which an English defence always will be.
There were some pretty big errors.
Absolutely. I'm not saying they have perfect defences, but if England don't have a very mobile and effective defence, it's going to be exposed because we give teams so many chances because we cannot keep the ball.
If only he'd taken Sol Campbell. Let's talk more about this in a second or two, right after we catch up with Raphael Honigstein, who's even now making his way back from today's game in Bloemfontein. Raphael, you join us from the middle of nowhere, correct?
Absolutely, James. I'm, 2 hours south of Johannesburg, but don't ask me where that is exactly.
All right, then. Germany's performance, one of the best team performances of the Cup so far?
Yes, I would say one of the best counter-attacking performances. They did something that I never really expected them to do, which is they decided, and Jogi Löw was very public about this in the press conference afterwards, they decided to give England the ball with this, you know, unspoken premise that England won't be able to keep it very long and will give it back to them. Whether it was by design or because it happened organically on the afternoon, it was stunningly effective.
Well, you've seen Germany's other games. Based on the result, it looks like we're slightly worse than Serbia and Ghana as a nation and possibly slightly better than Australia.
Yeah, that kind of sums it up for England. No, I mean, I felt that England played all right. In patches. When he got back into the game, they played their style. It's a surprisingly eloquent Lukas Podolski said afterwards, Germany negated England's strength to a large extent by defending very deep or as deep as they can and then hitting them on the counterattack. And, you know, all these things that I believed were going to be Germany's downfall, a naivety in midfield, a tendency to open up, it's all these things England did rather than Germany, the lesser experienced side. So I think it was impossible to predict. And also, I must say that Germany really surprised me. And I think they surprised themselves. They didn't really, I think, believe that they had this kind of game in themselves.
Is there any feeling among the German team and among the German press corps that they maybe got away with it a bit, that had Lampard's goal been allowed, which would have made it 2-2, that it would have been an entirely different game? Because in England, everyone's saying it wouldn't have made any difference. Germany were far superior. But is there a feeling among the Germans that they maybe dodged a bullet there?
Well, I haven't seen the tomorrow's match reports, of course, but I think that once the dust settles, that will be very much the line. And I completely agree with you. You saw after that 2-1, when Germany had fallen asleep for the corner and conceded a completely stupid goal, that this side was really being tested and they lost their rhythm completely and they lost their way. For 5-6 minutes, they were very close to conceding, and of course they did concede and it was unfairly ruled out. Now, I honestly believe that would have been a very different game. I think everybody subscribes to that. And it's easy to say now it would have made a difference, but I agree with you 100%. They looked rattled and they looked shaken and they were lucky to get into half time and then play the same game again. It's different when you have to start playing at 2-2 or you can just keep waiting for a counter-attack, which is what they did so well, of course, on the night.
Raphael, I was just wondering, it took about half a second here for the Capello bashing to start, and he seems to be a pretty common scapegoat, and the debate about whether or not England should have a foreign manager has come very predictably to the fore. What would be the reaction in Germany to having a foreign manager?
Well, they nearly went down that route in 1998 and then again in 2000, where Gus Hiddink was very far up the list, and of course they also talked to Roy Hodgson at the time. But there was a sense from the German FA that this was essentially a no-no, that regardless how bad it is, you have to kind of solve this problem from within rather than shooting somebody else in to sort it out for you. I honestly think that the management issue is almost an irrelevant. Well, let's rephrase that. It's not the main factor. When you look back to 2000, where Germany lost against England and had a disastrous Euro, Germany made a decision to look after the development of players much, much more. And it's really no coincidence that 10 years down the line, those guys were 10, 9, 8 years old then, now have emerged as really talented players. I think it's more important that they made that decision at the grassroots level rather than employing a wonderfully expensive but very smart coach.
Right, like some other nations have done. Bingo the dog is ruminating on whether Michael Ballack's injury has become a blessing in disguise for Germany. He says Germany's games during qualification to the World Cup. Did you actually play with that much flair and fluid counter-attack as on Sunday, or is this something you have developed precisely because of Ballack's absence?
They always threaten to play as fluidly, but they never quite managed to do it consistently. It was a little bit of a hit-and-miss campaign, the qualifying. Against Russia, they played tremendously well. It was more of a rear-guard action type game, and Ballack was really fantastic in both those games. So I think it's a little bit easy to say, oh, Germany minus Ballack equals wonderful, free-flowing, a great team. I still think that we would have really perhaps added that little bit of an extra dimension in terms of a mean streak, in terms of keeping the side better protected. And I still think there were signs, even today, that shows you that there is a big fragility and vulnerability at the back. And against Argentina, I'm confident Germany might score, but I'm less confident that they can keep a clean sheet.
All right. Well, in the meantime, Rafa, as you speed through the lonely, dark veldt on your journey, but you must be, even though we can't tell it necessarily from your voice, over the moon, though, at what you saw from your brave boys.
I was very, very impressed and very, very happy. And I honestly must say, you know, there was a big debate of just how big is this rivalry from a German perspective. And I think people still misunderstand a lot about how this rivalry or not, or one-sided nature of the rivalry works. But I can honestly tell you from the bottom of my heart, and I think most people saw it this way, that the pride came from Germany's performance, not because it was England on the other side, but because Germany played so well against a big team. That's where the happiness came from, not because England, a team that we want to see fail in some sort of sense, was knocked out.
All right, Rafa. Take care, then, on your drive back to Pretoria. And we look forward to speaking to you again soon.
It'll be my great pleasure, James.
And
take
ours
care.
Too, Rafael. Thank you very much once again for that excellent analysis.
It's kind of the violent insult, isn't it? It's not. We took most pleasure in the performance. It's absolutely
you
nothing
tell
to do with you.
He was expecting it, yeah.
And, you know, England just another team, really.
Just another team. Hmm. El Ronster says, how come the qualifiers were so good and now England are so bad? Beyond joking about your book, what happened? Was it just that the opposition in those qualifying matches was so bad?
There's no doubt the opposition weren't, you know.
But Algeria and Slovenia, whilst performing well in some cases against England, are not powers of world football.
It's strange, isn't it? I mean, a lot has been made of the German players being in a better physical condition, certainly by Franz Beckenbauer. And our players are never in a particularly good state by the time we get to a World Cup. But it was weird how England lost momentum after qualifying. The friendlies and the build-up, you didn't feel that was well used. I don't
John?
Know if that's something you thought, Ashdown?
Yeah, no, I do agree with you. I think the Croatia team, the two results over Croatia in qualifying were the crucial ones. And that was against a Croatia team that is very much in transition. But yeah, it is hard to explain. I think there's a sense of obviously it's a well-trodden path to say that the pressure gets them. But I think clearly it does. I don't know. It's odd to see them perform so differently. It really is.
I heard something the other day where somebody from the FA was saying how when Sven-Göran Eriksson took over, he asked for two things from the FA. One was to have a winter break and the other was to have five clear weeks.
Three things, I think.
I thought you were going to say something else. A really nice car.
Just pure football things he was talking about here. The other was to have a five clear week gap between the end of the season and the beginning of the World Cup.
Was that for his holidays? Or
I'm trying to make a point here, James. Give me a break. And anyway, the FA turned around and said, well, you can only have one because there's no way we can fit both those things into the the domestic season as it is. Right. So he went for the 5-week period and not the winter break. But I do think it's not a coincidence that England looked good in qualifying around sort of September, October, November, when the season domestically is just getting going and everybody's in full gear. And by the summer, everybody's completely knackered.
Beckenbauer's right.
Yeah.
Right. But also, I think there's a very good point in what Rafa said, that I think teams knew how to play England. Germany had a game plan, so did Algeria. The England players said this themselves. They're not letting us play. And Capello, surprisingly for the master tactician, went in with exactly the same tactics, didn't appear to have a plan B, and teams were set up to deal with this Emil Heskey-led 4-4-2, which they were unsurprisingly unmoved by.
Well, that's part of the problem, and quite a big part of the problem, I think, is that since 2003, of the players who play for England today, since only two of those made their debut after 2003. When it comes to Germany, there was 12 players in the 14 or 15 that played that made their debut in 2004 or later. And so this England team is just incredibly familiar to people. It's not doing anything different to what it did.
Well, there's a deeper problem there, isn't it? Because there are no other players pushing.
Well, that's the other thing.
There's no one coming through. Who are we going to pick? Rodwell. I mean, there are no young players coming through. We've got this bunch of people clinging on because there's no one to push them out of the team. And if you do skim off the older players in this England team, you're left with a very ordinary selection of players. And it's quite possible, if you look at how England have done in tournaments, I mean, they've been pretty terrible in this. I think 2004 and 98 are the only tournaments they've actually done what, you know, looked like a team who could get to the semi-finals or better since 1990. England could be heading for a Scotland-style spell in the wilderness because they simply don't produce players anymore.
Well, this is the mention of Rodwell brings to mind another point that I've been banging on about to anybody who listened for the last week. I remember watching Emil Heskey when he was 18.
No, I think we've got to move on, actually.
in about 1996. And he was a fantastic, very, very fast, very, very skillful winger tearing down the right wing Filbert Street for Leicester City. And at some point in the next 5 years or so, it was clearly decided that this guy didn't have the physique to be he wasn't a typical winger-style build player. And so, therefore, he had to get into the gym and turn himself into this great hulking centre forward who doesn't really move. And he should never have been that player. He should have, in other countries, he would have been allowed to become the player that he should have been, a fast, not necessarily a winger, he could have played up front, but like a sort of Ronaldo, old Ronaldo style forward, strong and powerful and able to take
Heskey.
This is Emil Heskey. That's the player he should have been.
He could have been more like Cristiano Ronaldo.
No, the old Ronaldo, the Brazilian.
Ronaldo the Brazilian.
He should have been that style of player, is what I'm saying.
What an incredible World Cup golden boot phenomenon.
In other countries, he wouldn't have been told to bulk up and become.
But you know, it's funny because that's exactly what happened to Ronaldo, and his injury problems stem from the fact that he was told to bulk up. Mm-hmm. But that's an aside.
My real point is that we haven't learned the lesson. And talking of Jack Rodwell, who's this wonderfully skillful central midfielder for Everton, mm-hmm. who looks like he's got huge amounts of potential. I think he's only 17, 18 now. Because he's big physically, David Moyes is always banging on about how eventually he'll be a centre-half. It's like, why does he have to be a centre-half just because he's big? Why can't he be a central midfielder? Why do we always have to put English players into these boxes? So if you're a winger, you've got to be 5'4" and be able to run really fast.
I was talking to Amanda Holden about Jack Rodwell the other day.
was she making more sense than me?
No, she was kind of drooling over him. There was a sense of drooling.
Really?
Yeah, she's an Everton fan.
Oh, okay.
She kept referring to him as that handsome boy.
Mm. Well, Thomas Muller, who was the best player on the pitch today, in this country, he's 6'1".
Mm.
He'd be, by the time he was 25, 26, he'd be playing the lumbering centre-forward role.
Do you think there's any sense that that's changing? And that the Premier League, which has developed in many ways the kind of football we see through the importation of foreign players, foreign managers, that it is beginning to broaden our parameters of
no, not for domestic players. I think we have to accept that the Premier League is a service economy league. We stage manage a brilliant league. We put it on very well, but it is not. We don't produce. It's pretty much like our entire economy. What we're very good at is managing other people's products, and we present a brilliant league to the world, but we don't have the kind of football economy that produces things anymore.
The two breakaway goals in the second half that Germany scored today, which were sensational, you see that in the Premier League. You can see that kind of goal, but you don't really see it from England very often.
Well, it's funny because Rooney is often involved in that kind of goal.
Yeah, Man United can score that kind of goal. Chelsea can score that kind of goal. it's not that uncommon to see a, you know, somebody's got a set piece at one end of the field and then suddenly there's a fantastic 12-second breakaway and a beautiful goal the other end. But yet, when was the last time anyone seen England do that on a regular basis?
It's a sense that most of those, Rooney plays alongside a lot of players who aren't available for
England. England players are very uniform, aren't they? We complement other styles of players very well. Like if Mexico had a Rooney and a Gerrard today, they'd be a fantastic team. And Gerrard has obviously looked at his best for Liverpool when he's played alongside Xavi Alonso. But we don't have a player like that. We instead have a lot of players who are very similar, very explosive and aggressive and look to go forward very quickly. But that doesn't make for a good team.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what the tabloids make of this on Monday morning, because I'm sure no one's let any of them know of the situation vis-a-vis. They continue to bang on with headlines, Will Stuffham and All Out Roar, etc. And as such, I mean, if anyone should be making apologies and resigning, etc., it should really be the people who feed these poor innocent supporters and their delusions in order to sell papers. I mean, they are enabling in that sense, in the sense of an addiction. And it really is, I think, very, very sad, because then people complain about the players. They've got no spirit. They let us down. They demonstrably weren't good enough. And the fault lies with the people who build up these expectations.
But I don't understand the spirit. I think the England players do have spirit. They were trying very hard.
They knew they were beaten,
but they're still trying to score a goal. They just were limited and were beaten by a better team.
There's no shame in losing to a better team.
No, indeed not. Listen, the Lampard goal, which we mentioned with Raphael, or the Lampard non-goal, which he concedes, might well have made a difference. And indeed, as episodes often do in football, it might well have had a crucial difference in the game.
Nobody's saying Germany are the perfect team. They had a bad period as well. But the fact is, to cling on to that is masking the fact that England scored 3 goals in 4 games and only beat Slovenia.
Yeah. Well, let me take it in a different direction and say, with that shot, and with the Tevez goal later on against Mexico, which was offside, everyone knew it was offside. There was even a replay in the stadium, a television screen showing that it was offside, and yet no action was taken. Is there any sense that this might be the last straw, the final move that forces, ultimately, some change from FIFA?
James.
No?
James, just think Paris. I'm sorry, FIFA, Sepp Blatter is if he wasn't the biggest jerk in football anyway. By blatantly ignoring the best possible reason to take some kind of measures in the aftermath of the France-Ireland game in the playoffs. That was a situation where the entire world had seen it and was, you know, pretty much up in arms. And they went off FIFA and said, right, OK, we're going to have a big investigation here. And what did they do? They came back. They didn't really even tick anybody off. And they said, actually, no, we're not going to use technology. We haven't changed our minds on that at all. Well, they had the perfect opportunity there. They bang on about integrity of sport, and it's absolute codswallop.
Well, Bernie disagrees with you.
You say that's codswallop. I mean, I like the argument that football is going to be the same whether it's played in the World Cup final or in a park, and that the rules are the same, you have a referee, and I think that's a nice argument. I don't think that's codswallop in itself. What do you think FIFA are hiding behind? If that's codswallop, why don't they want to do it?
Well, I agree with you, and I think we should cling to this idea here? That it is the same game.
Do you think that idea is a bad idea?
I think the referee should still have the final say, but if you've got a guy who's sitting there watching, and bearing in mind with particularly the Mexico-Argentina situation where it was on the big screen and 85,000 people saw it, and what was quite amusing about that is I'm not quite sure what the Argentinians were trying to say when they were surrounding them.
They thought he was going to chalk it off.
I know, but I mean, you know, they'd seen it too. So
over there,
look there instead. Someone with a funny hat on. You know. But going back to the point, if you've got someone who's sitting there watching, who's within that 3 or 4 second period, it's really not going to waste an awful
Which
lot of time.
Which
they
do.
They were 2 minutes anyway. Arguing the toss with the lines.
Barney, what you're saying
the
is
got someone saying there was a replay in the stadium, and that caused great confusion.
No, but even if there wasn't, I mean,
how many times is it clear cut? Maybe half the time.
All right, it's
you're
not always
clear cut.
You're
going to have people on the touchline arguing, pointing up at a screen, saying, look, that is offside.
No, I think if you've got one video referee whose job is to give an opinion to the referee, it's still the referee's decision that's final, but that the referee can turn and say, do you know what, I'm not sure about that, no matter what you've said.
I have to say I'm agreeing with this because it's there. It doesn't take anything being put in, as everybody says. You've got the fourth official there. He used to have a monitor. I think they took that away because people were kind of coming over and having a look over his shoulder. But he just has to have a monitor with the TV output, and within 10 seconds of the ball going over the line, he's seen the replay. And if the referees wave play on or something, he can say, oi, ref, call it back. That was a goal. He doesn't have to use those words. That was just my own suggestion. You, Barney, quite rightly say, well, that's fine for a televised game, but what about the games that aren't televised? You know, Division 2 match when they don't have access to that kind of thing, they can't use that kind of referee's assistance. But to me, it's still, I do take your point, but to me, it's just illogical when everybody knows, when everybody's aware within seconds that the goal is wrong.
It's only clear-cut on a few occasions.
Right, but when it is clear-cut, like today, when everybody knew within seconds, even watching it the first time that Lampard's ball had gone in.
Even opinions on when it's clear-cut differ. Like, there are people who say that is obviously offside, that is obviously a penalty. Are you going to replay every single incident?
No,
because someone will think that that is obviously...
No, because you're going to have a qualified referee watching it. You see, I agree that it's not always available.
We've already got qualified referees watching it, and they...
Yeah, but not with the benefit of actually seeing what happened to the replay.
Well, I've sat there watching the greatest minds in football, i.e. Graham Souness, Jamie Redknapp and Ruud Gullit, debate whether something is obviously a penalty or not.
I agree, sometimes
that situation,
things aren't clear.
You leave it to the ref. The ref can do whatever they like.
But the point is, people will still be arguing with his decision, even though he's seen it on television and said, well, I think that's a penalty. We'll still be sitting here, what are we going to do? Review
it
the
narrows the margin of error.
Decision?
No, it narrows the margin of error.
No, it introduces
it's
a
bit like saying,
error.
Because you can't have life belts on every ship everywhere in the world. You shouldn't have any on any.
No, because
this is something which will save injustices.
I don't think the television review is the football equivalent of a life belt. It's another tool for debate.
I think a lot of England fans would regard it as one today, and probably Irish fans as well in the match in Paris. Amy rules the world and gives me a job as Minister of Video Technology, it will run as an ordinary football match, but only that the fourth official, or fifth, or sixth, or whichever guy it is sitting there just watching the monitor, and if he notices a glaring injustice of the nature of which we've seen two in one day of World Cup football, he will press his little button and speak over his little comm set to the referee and say, hey, stop, that wasn't a goal, or hey, stop, it was. It really
like
is out
in Stardust in those
70s. And what happens when there's a
safety advert?
But what happens when there's a big disagreement over what is a glaring injustice or not?
Well, then he doesn't say anything.
If he's not certain, then he doesn't say anything. Anyway, you're still going to have people disputing it.
Well, I think it's going to... I'm not saying it's going to make football black and white, but it would reduce the margin of error. Only in games that are televised, but at least it would do it there.
I think even when you looked at the Italian referees at Rossetti's face today.
Oh, God, yeah. And Airoldi, the chap who knew, oh, my God.
It was actually quite excruciating to watch because they were clearly conscious that something wrong had happened and that they weren't quite sure how to make it right. I think they're a bit in a straitjacket because they can't really, at the moment, use that technology, so they couldn't go back and change the decision.
Was the ball going in anyway, though? This was the opening goal for Argentina against Mexico, who'd had a bright start to that game, didn't they, Mexico?
Yeah, I don't think it was going in. I think Tevez had to finish it off.
Right.
But you're right, it totally threw Mexico. You know, they lost it for 15 minutes, and they were still upset at the start of the second half, and that was the game for them.
Right.
It was a real shame. The game was very level at that point. And it did ruin the game, without doubt, although it's hard to say that Argentina didn't deserve to win in the end because they took advantage of that.
Probably, based on the way the teams played the rest of the game, they would have gone through. It was, what, 3-1 the final score?
Yeah.
And some cracking goals. Tevez, his second goal.
That was amazing, yeah. Just absolutely
paint a picture for us, Barney.
Well, it was a bit of a loose ball, 25 yards out, and he just ran onto it first time and spanked it into the top corner. It was a brilliant goal.
Threaker of a
I like Hernandez's goal for
He looks good, doesn't he? Yeah, he's a good player.
He's been the fastest player at the tournament so far.
Has he?
According to
FIFA
stats, tell me.
Well, they can use technology for 30, that, can
32
they?
32 kilometres an hour.
Right.
Oh, that his top speed?
Yeah.
That sounds really fast.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, Argentina's steaming along anyway, and Messi hasn't even opened his account yet. Much for the Albiceleste to be happy about. Let's hear now from a long-time friend of the pod, Marcela Moreirajo. Marcela, are you there?
I am here, James.
Happy
it's lovely
news.
To hear you say my name.
Yeah. listen, you must be in a pretty happy mood right now.
Yes, I think happy. I think joy is a word we all like to say. Alegría, as the old songs to Maradona go back in Argentina. I think there's a sense that maybe we were lucky today. But we've earned our way here. And how I say we, because I feel I've contributed somehow. But great, great result, if a little controversy around some areas of the overall...
Were you running the line today, Marcela?
No. That would never happen if I was running.
You certainly got the hair for it. Bunny was admiring the way that, say, Tevez came off, and he and Maradona had this kind of great kind of brunette hair mop off together. And so
that was a lovely moment, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
I think it's part of this whole thing we've been seeing Maradona do this World Cup. I mean, a lot of us have been wondering throughout the qualifying stages and the build up, was he up to it? What was his contribution going to be? And it does seem that the love is a huge part of it, and I think it is real. It was very moving to see them celebrate. I was with a lot of Argentinians in a grill, and some of them were speculating that Tevez was saying, "I promised you I would do it," and others were speculating that, in fact, what Tevez was saying was, "I scored a good one," because the first one was a bit dodgy, you know, and Maradona knows about the concept of compensating for a dodgy goal with a superb one.
I think Tevez said, "Please stop rooting around in my hair and keep your hands to yourself."
He didn't say anything of the sort, but I am confused, though. How much work does Diego actually do?
Well, I think quite a lot, actually.
Really?
I mean, I don't know for a fact. As a player, he was very, very hardworking, and people always who know him well and who've spent time with him do point this out. He was first at training, the last to leave. Through the last year, we've been wondering what goes on. I mean, I've heard people comment that he never gives a single kind of specific tactical instruction, that most of his everyday discourse is about saying, "Well done, that's the way I like it." But I think we've probably underestimated his tactical knowledge. And when I say we, I mean the press as a whole, and perhaps the Argentinian press. Not knowledge, but also kind of ability to implement. Until tonight, some of his changes were inspired. Some of his press conferences showed an enormous amount of detail gone into the planning of all sorts of things, you know, specific players' abilities, observation of the rivals. And in fact, or even some people have been pointing out very Bilardo-style obsessive touches, like getting players to warm up from very early on so they're all ready, you know, things like that, the substitutes, I mean, not the players on the pitch. Tonight, there was a little bit of more of a confusion. I'm not sure. I think, you know, they'll probably have to do a lot more thinking or talking. Like Diego likes to say, we talked a lot about Jonas's little problem, or, you know, we've talked about how Mitu can compensate for Jonas, and he calls them all by first names and nicknames. And I think what we've seen so far is that football is clearly what he's comfortable with, what he understands, what he knows, and he's so in his element. I wouldn't question his commitment and his understanding of the game, and I mean everything about the World Cup, you know, not just the 90 minutes on the pitch.
Excellent, Marcella. Thank you so much for joining us this evening, and we look forward to hearing more about the whole Argentina adventure as this continues.
My commiserations to the English fans. I think that Lampard goal was super.
Indeed. Never mind, Dave. Post, Simpliskins is excited by the fact that FIFA have acknowledged problems with the ball and will investigate after the tournament. But he says, what's the point of investigating after the event? They won't be using it at the next World Cup anyway. I also like the poster who said, Art Deco, video technology, he agrees with FIFA, video technology would destroy the true feeling and tradition of the game, as opposed to introducing a colourful new petrol station ball every 2 years. Yes.
The only thing that bothers me about all that, sorry to go on about
ball,
it again, is...
Or the video.
What do people think is FIFA's secret agenda in this? I've never quite worked it out. Is it just to keep television out of football?
I don't know.
I don't understand what...
I really don't know what it is.
Is it just pigheadedness?
Might be. Okay. Some people posting in saying, why did we gloss over South Korea in Saturday's pod? Yeah. Sorry about that. Yesterday's pod was recorded backwards, almost literally, John. And in the course of that, maybe South Korea's contribution to an exciting day of football was a little bit understated, or under-reflected. So our apologies. Man U for Life says, every time Sven's name is mentioned in the podcast, Mr. Richardson goes all soft and never completely criticises Sven. Can someone tell us why Sven is treated with such reverence by Mr. Richardson? And what's not to love about Sven? I have to come clean here, full disclosure. On one of my early missions in Italy, I went to Sampdoria to do a thing, and he was manager at the time. And I said, can I get an interview with you, Sven, because you speak English? And he said, no, I have to go now. But he said, you can come to my house. So we got into his Volvo.
He didn't approach you in an inappropriate way,
no,
did he?
No.
Were you wearing those shorts?
So sinister.
No.
So we went to his house, and we had lunch. Right. And later, as he was stroking me. And
he cleared away the dishwasher. And yeah.
You spoil my story.
What happened after lunch?
No, he gave me an interview on the terrace overlooking the
very intoxicating views.
Oh, it was gorgeous.
Yeah. You get carried away, don't you, in the moment?
Anyway, and the fact is, he's been a kind of constant of my very inconstant career ever since, because he keeps turning up, you know, then at Lazio, and then the England job, and then when I Ukraine, England.
Are you going to the Ivory Coast next?
No, well, he's not there anymore. No. But he will, for all of us, he just keeps turning up. And there's also the enigma of how he does it, because when you meet him, he doesn't have that kind of arrogance of a Capello, or the kind of cut me and I bleed football of a Trapattoni or something like that. It is just extraordinary how he manages to get himself, and does a reasonable job at many of them, these really top places in football, which he has.
Notts County.
Notts County, yeah.
Came at me from nowhere.
He's obviously got a good agent.
I don't know, I just treasure the absurdity of him and his career.
His agent is an opera singer. Really? Quite an odd fellow.
Anyway, Sven-Göran Eriksson, long may he continue to pop up. Monday, the Netherlands and Slovakia are playing off, and so are Brazil and Chile, and the winners of those two games will go into a semi-final against the winner of Uruguay-Ghana. Okay, Slovakia were very exciting against Italy, of course, 3-2. Shock of the tournament. Can they do it again against Holland?
Yes, I think they can.
Do you?
Well, yeah, I mean, Holland really haven't been that impressive, I don't think, so far. And it doesn't look like Arjen Robben or Elia is going to start tomorrow, and so there's not necessarily going to be any improvement in their performance until the sort of hour mark when those two come on and change the game. By which stage, Slovakia, who are dependable at the back and have discovered some tremendous goal scoring form, and Robert Vitek in his form of his life.
And Hamzic started playing well in the last game. Because you say Holland haven't done that well. They've won all their games so far.
Yeah, but look at without impressing.
Yeah,
really.
But Slovakia have drawn with New Zealand, lost to Paraguay, and then rolled over the decaying
coast. Yeah, I suppose it's the primacy of something.
But they did play differently in that third group game, and I think Hamzic was a lot to do with that. The question is whether Lightning can strike twice, or am I being unfair to them?
I'm not sure they're the team to beat Holland. You're right that Holland haven't been very impressive. I think Robin van Persie, we forget what a good player Van Persie is, even though he's been injured. But, I mean, he's had a lot of time to get back to something approaching his best form. And I think he could make a difference, possibly. I mean, I think he'll have a moment at this World Cup.
And Robin, you think, is only going to come on towards the end?
Well, I don't think it seems unlikely to start. Whether that's
Elia? Do you think there's any room for Elia getting into the side?
Well, I mean, they've decided that the way they're going to play is in a fairly solid fashion with Kout and Van der Vaart as the two wide players of their front three or midfield five, if you prefer. Perhaps a more adventurous coach would go for Elia and Robin on the two wings, which would be a far more exciting and attacking formation.
Right.
Yeah, but I don't think he will. I don't think they might think that they don't need to because it's only little Slovakia.
Right, but that would be an error.
Which could be their undoing. Yeah,
it could do. And that's followed in the evening by Brazil-Chile. Now, Chile was second in World Cup qualifying behind Brazil, ahead of Argentina. They won more games in World Cup qualifying than Brazil, and they've looked a feisty bunch thus far. However, as mentioned yesterday, Brazil have won the last seven meetings with them, scoring 26 goals against Chile and conceding just three. They certainly did a number of them both in Santiago. 3-0 Brazil won there, and then 4-2 back at home. Oh, Nilmar got a hat-trick. Fernando Duarte is our go-to guy for everything Brazilian. Let's get a quick update from him. Fernando, where in South Africa are you?
Hello, James. I'm still in Durban.
Oh, okay.
Still in what was supposed to be like the sunny Durban, but today was rainy.
The last thing you went to was that Portuguese game, yeah? Brazil-Portugal, very disappointing. Have you recovered?
Yeah, I'm still a bit disappointed with the quality of the football displayed by Brazil, but, it's another day, another game, and this time, you cannot lose. It's a knockout stages, and Chile, my promise to be a bit more motivated opponent.
It should be a very different kind of performance this time with Kaká, Elano back, and also Robinho.
Yeah, they should, and also, against Portugal, there was also that relaxation factor, both teams were qualified, And I also think that the return of Kaká, Leno and Robinho will make the team perform better. But the thing is, Brazil hasn't lost to Chile in a long, long time. I think the last time we lost to them was basically in the qualifiers for the 2002 World Cup. Mm-hmm. Other than that, it's been Brazil so far. I think Dunga, with Dunga, we've won basically all the matches against Chile. They're playing pretty much good football this time. I don't think they actually should trouble Brazil. But you never know. You know, that's the magic of football.
Okay. You were quite down before you went out to South Africa about Brazil's chances overall. Are you feeling a bit more positive now?
I think it's not going to come to the quarterfinals. If we play against the Dutch, that could be a very, very difficult game. The funny thing is, Brazil has fallen in a very easy part of the draw. Imagine Argentina have to play the Germans now, and then in the semifinals play another tough opponent. For them to play either Brazil or Holland at the moment in the final, they could do it. One thing this team has done is actually click at the right time. I was just a bit disappointed with the quality of the football. But you never know.
Fernando, thanks. Sorry for disturbing you on a Sunday night. And, best of luck with the game.
No problem at all. I mean, I was just really sorry for England. I just want to say to all England fans, I mean, come on, these things happen. And it's always another day.
There is always another day for these things to happen all over again. Thank you so much, Fernando. Look forward to speaking to you again soon.
It's the sympathy that kills you.
It's the what?
The sympathy. Yeah. How much more could anybody take?
But, you know, it might be the Brazilians having a bit of sympathy tomorrow, because Chile, everybody loves Chile with their crazy 3-3-1-3 formation and all that kind of thing. They did pick up more bookings, probably, John, you were about to say this, than any other team in the group stages.
Committing more fouls as well, I think.
Yeah.
So fully deserved.
And as a result, they are going to be without one or two players in this game. Estrada, who, of course, was sent off so, unjustly, really, for that very minor
strange
collision, if indeed
Torres,
there was any collision with Torres in the Spain game. But they played brilliantly. Their lion-hearted performance truly was a lion-hearted performance with 10 men against Los Furios Rojas or whatever.
Certainly for the non-South American people who probably haven't seen that much of them recently, they've been a real pleasant surprise and everybody's enjoying watching them. But whether that's enough to get past what is such a resilient-looking Brazil side,
yeah,
I think it's going to be quite difficult.
They created a lot of chances in the group games but didn't take as many as they probably should have done. And you imagine they won't get quite as many chances against Brazil. And they would have to be more clinical than they've been so far, certainly.
Yeah. Gary Medel out, Marco Estrada out, and Waldo Ponce as well. So it is a weakened Chile side that faces this Brazil team, whose only doubt, I think, is Felipe Melo, one of their two midfield enforcers. It's going to be interesting to see how those games turn out. That's where we're going to sign off for Sunday. We'll be back after Monday's games, of course, at the usual time. So do join us for that. In the meantime, many thanks to guest producer Ian and Barney Rene, John Ashdown, and to you, Amy Lawrence. Speak to you tomorrow.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.